High culture meets high technology at the bleeding edge of the radical right. Majority Rights Radio.
Hello, you're on the air with Majority Rights Radio. T. Keith Preston, welcome. Andrew Yeoman, welcome.
Thanks, Soren. It's glad to be here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
All right. Mr. Yeoman and Mr. Preston, I have a question in mind for each one of you, a separate question. Two questions. But why don't you first briefly introduce yourselves, Mr. Yeoman?
Sure. Well, my name's Andrew Yeoman, and I live in San Francisco. And for the last 3 years, I've been the spokesman for a group called the Bay Area National Anarchists. And BANA is an activist organization and community service group that does things like street protest, environmental cleanups, and charity fundraisers. And among other things, we promote stronger local communities and tribalism through our efforts. And we have the long-term political goal of promoting and establishing a secessionist movement for the 9 Bay Area counties to secede away from the California state authorities and the federal authorities.
So scrapping with Antifa is not actually part of your mission?
No, not really. They're actually what I call the enforcers of the system.
Right. Yeah, I saw a really good SIG line a while back. I think it was maybe on Stormfront, maybe on VNN, but it was just a signature line. Fuck you, hippie. You are the system.
Very pertinent.
Yeah, yeah. Mr. Preston, you also came from the anarchist left, I believe.
Yes, I was involved in that milieu. Well, I first became involved with it probably about 25 years ago, and I was involved in that scene for about 15 years, 10
so
or 15
you're,
years.
So you're in your 40s or 50s?
I am 44 years old as of next month. So, yeah, I've been around for a little while. I started out in that milieu when I was in my late teens. I was involved in it up until I was almost 30.
I picture Andrew Yeoman as being about 30 now. Is that right?
I'm in my late 20s.
Yeah, okay. Go on, Mr. Preston.
Yeah, so I started becoming interested in ideas from what is now called the alternative right or the third position or the new right. And I started incorporating some of that into my own approach and trying to bring some of that into the anarchist milieu. Around the same time, I discovered national anarchism, which was a tendency that was developing in Europe at the same time. That was around 2000. About that same time, I launched a website called AttackTheSystem.com, of which I'm the chief editor. And that's essentially been my main project for about a decade now, and that's trying to fuse traditional anarchism with some ideas lifted from the European New Right. And also, Andrew mentioned his interest in secession. I, too, am interested in secession. I've been involved, at least peripherally, in the North American secessionist movement. I was at a conference of the various secessionist groups a couple of years ago, engaged in some networking in that area as well.
That's interesting. By the way, do either of you two gentlemen know who James Bowery is? It seems to me...
Oh, yeah. Wait, I know a Jonathan Bowden.
No, not Jonathan Bowden. James Bowery. I think
I am not familiar with him. No.
Yeah, I think at some point I'll have to get you one of you on the line with James Bowery talking because he's very interesting. He's not from the anarchist left, but he's got ideas about politics and economics. I'm sure you'd be interested in. The best way I can describe him is it's sort of a lot of it's like Henry. You know who Henry George was?
Oh yes.
Progress, like strange, like neo-Georgism. He doesn't call it that. Anyway, our listeners know exactly who James Bowery is, so they're not confused at all. But please go on. So you put your heart and your soul into the anarchist left, and naturally, once you made this turn to the right inside, you tried to hide it from your colleagues lest they turn on you and tear you to pieces, right? How did that work?
Well, I personally didn't hide it. I was always pretty out front about, you know, my changing views over time and my criticisms of the anarchist left as it was. And for that, for my efforts, I had a lot of brickbats thrown in my direction. I still get that all the time, but it doesn't really bother me. My interest is in telling the truth, wherever the truth may lead. And if some people can't handle the truth, well, too bad for them.
Yes, and you found that the truth led to the extreme right.
Partially. I suppose I would consider myself more in the third position than the extreme right, per se. My views today are a blending of left and right ideas.
Right. That amounts to is that you get far enough left or far enough right that it ends up being the same place because it wraps around.
Exactly. The political
spectrum. Position, you can't get more extreme than the third position, as far as I know.
No, the political spectrum is more of a circle than a straight line, meaning if you go very far in
I prefer to think of it as an ellipse tilted away from us. And what most people think are the extremes are simply the limbs of the ellipse as it tilts away from us. So the farthest left and right. So most people don't notice the backside where the real extremists are. This is my image of it. You understand what I'm saying?
Oh, yes.
That's just my image of it. But I think, as far as I can tell, the canonical difference between the left and right when you get to the extremes is only race, as far as I can tell.
To a large degree, I think you're correct. There's a handful of other cultural issues, but I think that the kinds of views on race are really the things that set them apart.
But you could have a complete leftist, extreme leftist, anarchist point of view on everything except race, and you would be considered part of the extreme right.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yes.
Okay. I mean, it probably doesn't work the other way. If you had extreme right viewpoints on everything except race, but you were in favor of the multicultural Tower of Babel and the Jewish project to, you know.
Then you're just a neocon.
Right. Exactly. Right. Exactly.
Well, that's the system we have now, sort of more or less.
Mm-hmm.
But I also I want to be very careful in this interview because I don't know about you, Mr. President. Mr. Yeoman, I sense that he is very careful about expressing his views. He's very careful not to say certain things, and I don't want to say anything that will, you know, give the game away and prevent him from.
Oh, well, I'm also pretty forthright in my views. I do tend to focus on contemporary issues rather than historical ones.
History. History is a nightmare from which we are trying to awaken. I mean, surely we've heard enough about the so-called excesses of the previous millennium or two.
Right.
Did you see my speech I gave at the London New Right?
Of course.
Yeah, I saw that as well.
Do you remember what I said about a moral jubilee? Which is simply to say, if anybody brings up anything that happened before 2000, say, I've decided not to have any moral feelings about anything that happened before the year 2000. It's very useful.
Yeah, of course, I can see that.
It would be useful if I ever got in those conversations, which I never do anymore.
Yeah.
I may have to adopt that. That sounds like a good plan.
Really? You guys both saw my... You saw Mr. Preston, despite the fact that I had never heard of you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'll tell you, that's an asymmetry there. I wonder if shall we have to correct that?
Well, I'm interested in the new right, and I've seen a lot of the videos that are available on YouTube and elsewhere of lectures from the new right gatherings. You know,
I took all those. I took all the video from that one.
Mm-hmm.
So I did did Lady Renouf speak? I think maybe she didn't speak, but
some interview footage with her that was available online from that particular conference.
Yeah, I took that. And actually, it was really wonderful because she said she really liked it. She was very concerned about the camera angles that I got her from, and then she said she really liked my speech, and she invited me and Peter Griffin, who's her filmmaker friend, to go back to her flat by Hyde Park in Kensington, and she made me a wonderful dinner, all in aid of, like, actually transferring from my... I had a mini DV camera. They wanted to transfer the tape and get the recording themselves so that they had a copy of it, of the footage of her.
Mm-hmm.
And because she wanted to get this, she was very, very, very charming. And she invited me home, and, you know, it was wonderful. Very posh. But I filmed Norman Lowell, too. That was fun. Do you remember that Norman Lowell, when he was speaking, that she was heckling him?
I don't particularly remember that incident.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's wonderful. But I agree, Bowden is absolutely one amazing speaker.
Well, Bowden's discussion of the Frankfurt School that was at one point available on YouTube and maybe some other places is quite good. That's quite a good lecture.
Yeah, and apparently he never uses notes, and apparently he can just, like, do that.
Those are the best kinds of public speakers.
Actually, he actually froths a little bit.
Well, you know, he comes from a long line of British oratory tradition that, you know, they can do stuff like that. When I was more involved in the left-wing scene, and I was associating with communists of various sorts, when you come across a trained Marxist orator, you will have a speaker that will get the entire room roused and passionate about whatever issue it is they're discussing, and you will want to leave the room that moment and do what needs to be done.
Well, he's something of a he's something of a little bit of a polymath too. He and I were chatting about Wyndham Lewis a little bit after his talk on Carlyle, and he said, and I was only in London for like 2 days, and he said, well, you should walk down from where you're staying and go to the National Portrait Gallery because there's a special show. You know how a museum has that will have like a, you know, their exhibit, and then they'll have a special show that costs a little bit more. A special exhibit. They had a special exhibit, portraiture of Wyndham Lewis, who was an author and a painter. And as an author, I'm very interested in him. So I got to see that show, and I wouldn't have, except that Bowden told me about it. It was really wonderful.
Hmm.
Of course, you've never heard of Wyndham Lewis. But take it from me. It's interesting. But the point is, Bowden has heard of the stuff I've heard of to a great extent, which makes it very amusing for me to talk to him.
Mm-hmm.
But what about you guys? The important thing is to enjoy this interview, not to talk about people who aren't here.
Well, what's on your mind?
Okay, so, Mr. Preston, what did you like about Alistair Clark, and why are you sorry you never got to meet him?
Well, I found his blog to be rather interesting. I never had any personal correspondence with him, so he's not someone that I knew personally, not even online. But
that would be Aryan Futurism?
Correct, yes. Yeah, I found, in particular, I found his interest in neo-paganism to be interesting. His ideas on homosexuality, you know, his role as a gay man who totally rejected what is commonly called the gay rights movement, and his embrace of the politics of the European New Right. That would make him something of an enigma, certainly in America, and probably in Europe as well, I would imagine.
Hmm. I'm trying to find this quote, but keep talking. One of you keep talking.
Okay, yeah, and his work was really interesting. Just reading his blog, I believe, is still up. It's that's why I linked to it, because he has some really interesting posts there, really interesting discussions, for example, on the Abrahamic religions and Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and their...
Yeah, I found the quote. Alistair Clark, I found this wonderful quote. The new right Weltanschauung is unassailable. It is the adamantine synthesis of the most brilliant minds in European history, from Heraclitus to Martin Heidegger and beyond, and the race mind which created foundational Aryan mythology. It is the intellectual equivalent of Fortress Europe. The spirit of Europe will never be crushed, neither by force of arms, nor by decades of toxic propaganda, nor by a treacherous plutocratic elite groveling to yet another Abrahamic religion.
Well, that's a hell of a quote.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really is. So let me just continue by asking you guys if you've heard of and what you think of various names. So, Norman Lowell.
I used to correspond with a fellow who was a close friend of Norman Lowell. For a while, I was on the involved with a group called the Renaissance Party of North America, and there was a fellow involved in that that I was on the steering committee with, who was heavily involved with some folks in Malta, with including Norman Lowell. And Norman Lowell is not someone whom I'm extremely familiar with. I have looked over some of his work and found his ideas to be interesting, his ideas of an imperial Europa and so forth. He
right.
strikes me as being fairly strongly within the conservative revolutionary tradition.
Andrew?
I have seen one talk of his and don't know enough about him to make an opinion.
Okay. All right. So what I'm really interested in, and I didn't know this before I started, but I'm really interested in the fact that you both came out of the left. I think we could use up the time just talking about that, what they're like. But for or against, true or false, the Antifa are dangerous. To come to the attention of the Antifa is as dangerous as to pick up a serpent. Agree or disagree?
Disagree.
I would disagree. I'd say that the a serpent is a more immediate danger. The Antifa are potentially dangerous in the sense that they engage in unprovoked violence and so forth. But like most people who are cowardly, they only work very well if they travel in packs. They're fairly easy to protect yourself against, except for in extraordinary circumstances.
Or serpent stances.
Yes.
Right.
I've never had any physical confrontations with them myself. I've gotten harassing phone calls from them and that kind of thing.
Okay, that's good. Andrew, have you ever had a physical altercation with an Antifa?
Yeah, once or twice.
I think I saw the video of that.
Yeah.
Why did they get off with the misdemeanors?
Well, that's a case that is still in trial, so I'm not able to really comment on that. So, cowards, need groups in order to instigate, violence. You know, it's typical bully behavior.
Now, this doesn't relate exactly to Antifa, but to the extreme left. It relates to the fairly extreme left. Did you hear about the warrants, the search warrants that were served in Chicago 2 or 3 days ago? And Minneapolis?
On some anti-war activists?
Yes.
Yes, I have heard about that, yes.
Did you check into that? I've been trying to figure out what's up. They're having a protest, the leftists, at the FBI building in Chicago tomorrow. It seems to me that, like, protesting outside the FBI building is not necessarily the best use of one's time when one has been subpoenaed for an October 5th grand jury appearance. But, mm-hmm. That's just me. So I don't know what they're looking for, in the grand jury. Apparently, they wanted to find out where some people had been spending their time when they were in Palestine, touring Palestine. So looking for travel itineraries, maps, things like that. So it's apparently about material support to Palestinian and maybe FARC in Colombia terrorists. Material support, aid and comfort and whatnot. And the leftists are hopping mad about it.
I'd mad about it, too. The government should stay out of political activist business.
Right. But do either of you know anything about this whole thing about what happens when you're called before a grand jury?
Not particularly.
It's rather harrowing because the government has all the cards. You're not allowed to have a lawyer. Do you know that?
I know that if you
as a witness.
Yes, if you're subpoenaed in front of a grand jury as a witness, you're not allowed to have a lawyer because you're not a defendant. Therefore, in terms of legal theory, your right to counsel doesn't apply because you're not the accused.
You can have a lawyer in the corridor, but he can't come into the room with you.
Well, you do have the right of the Fifth Amendment. You can legally take the Fifth Amendment if you so choose. However, it's also true that if they decide to give you immunity, then your Fifth Amendment rights become null and void, and they can just simply waive your rights by granting you immunity. And then, right. In a circumstance like that, if you then refuse to testify, you're actually held in contempt. And contempt charges are extremely serious. You can be jailed indefinitely on those kinds of charges.
Yeah. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with that. But the left seems to operate with almost impunity here in Chicago. The Antifa group that I've had the most personal trouble with, one of their semi-leaders is actually a computer hacker who did time for stealing credit card numbers from some other political site. And so he's a felon, and he still gets arrested time and time again for, you know, tearing down the banner at the Olympics when Chicago was applying for the Olympics. And a bunch of them were arrested in a car driving away from a restaurant in the suburbs last December after throwing paint across the books at a David Irving restaurant, like, talk. So they broke in, disrupted a talk, threw a plate at somebody. And, you know, they got off with the misdemeanors, even though the guy's an ex-felon. So, I don't know.
Well, it would be interesting to see what kind of connection these groups have to local government, to local law enforcement, to groups like the Democratic Party. There's something of a pyramid where a lot of so-called grassroots activists, or, you know, whatever you want to call them, from the hard left, actually have connections at times, and funding from you know, more higher up.
You've been listening to Andrew Breitbart, haven't you?
No, I'm not familiar with him.
Oh,
well, what I'm talking about now is fairly standard knowledge. It's not anything that's any big secret.
Oh, yeah. No, they definitely do have support. But, you know, I don't know if this is any interest to our listeners. It might be vaguely interesting. But anyway, we can't discuss the specifics of the San Francisco case because it's still being litigated, right, Andrew?
Yes.
But there's no chance they'll bump those back up to felonies, I take it.
I really don't know.
Okay.
That's rare that that happens in judicial procedures. It can happen, but it's not very common.
Yeah. So I guess what I want to hear from both of you is I want to hear stories from your anarcho-leftist past.
Okay. Well, I have quite a few stories there. What in particular would you like to know about?
Okay, you're young, you're green, you're 17. For some reason, you get involved with some girl. She's a left-wing punk. She's got, like, I'm guessing she's got, like, safety pins through her ears, blue-black dyed hair, ripped jeans, and you're so in love with this girl, you become a leftist, right? Is that how it happened?
Well, no, that's not really how it happened with me. I actually was involved in the anti-war movement in the 1980s. That was really my first exposure to the left. It was the question of the war in Central America at the time, which at the time many people thought would end up being another Vietnam War in terms of you know, a quagmire that America would get sucked into. And so my first initial activism was as a part of that movement. It was interesting to me because a lot of the activists I met in that milieu in the anti-war movement were either communists. They were involved with groups like the Socialist Workers Party, which is a Trotskyite group, or the Workers World, which is an old Stalinist group, and the RCP, a Maoist group. And then there were also a lot of left-wing Christians involved in that.
The RCP, when I was 15 years old and a freshman at University of Michigan, there were RCP people, and also Spartacist Youth League in Ann Arbor. And I didn't like the dorms too well. So for that winter, I tried to move into a co-op. They have these residential co-ops in Ann Arbor. And one co-op, I did move into one, but Deb's house, Eugene V. Deb's house, named after the socialist. But in my attempts to look at co-ops to live in, I had dinner at Joint House, called Joint because there were two houses next to each other that had an extension, like, joining them up.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's just what they called it. It really meant to light up a joint.
Well, I think that was part of the humor of it. Mm-hmm. But in any case, in that little one-story annex joining the two houses is where they had their dining room. And so I went for a meal there. And dining there, apparently living at Joint House, was this girl that I had seen around campus known as Squeaky. And Squeaky was a very thin, dirty blonde hair, junky looking type. She was, I think she was Sparta's Hest Youth League, either that or RCP. And she was always being arrested in East Quad for distributing like communist literature and like fighting with the police and stuff. But there she showed up at Joint House. Apparently she lived there. And they had at one point during dinner, one hippie bearded type individual stood up and said, "Does anybody have any business to discuss with the house?" You know. And Squeaky stood up and started squeaking about the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan and the glorious, like, Russian attempt to free their Afghani brothers or something. And everybody was just like, "Squeaky, shut up and sit down." And I realized, oh my God, this happens every night. So that's my story about the RCP. Hello?
Yes, if they were a pro-Soviet invasion of Afghanistan group, it was probably the Spartacus League. That was the line they took. I actually knew some Sparts back in those days who were actually trying to get a brigade of American communists to go fight in Afghanistan.
But it was just so funny. This passive-aggressive, colorless, junkie-type individual, like always getting into fights with the police and squeaking about Afghanistan and being suppressed. Like, it reminded me of the Dormouse, you know, in Alice in Wonderland. Remember the court scene where they have to suppress it? Anyway, go on.
Well, you find that kind of thing all over the place on the left, or at least that particular subculture of the left. I became interested in the anarchists because of my disgust with the communists and with these liberation theology Christians. You know, I had been associating with them in the anti-war movement. And I decided, you know, well, okay, I know I'm in the anti-war movement. What is my political identity? And I didn't really like what a lot of the people around me were doing, so I started looking up on different beliefs and philosophies, and I decided I was an anarchist, just comparing different things with each other. And that was really before I even knew any anarchists. And then a short time after that, I started actually associating with anarchists, and I was, you know, right from the start, I was profoundly disappointed with what I found, and that disappointment grew over time.
Okay. Please. Give me specifics.
Well, the anarchist milieu then as now was mostly a subculture of, mostly I'd say a youth culture, a subculture.
Did they have people like living together in like group houses, communes?
You had some of that. I wouldn't say that was the norm. I'd say it was more just a youth subculture, mostly students, some bohemian types and so forth, espousing a very far left, hard left political outlook.
Any commonalities with the Sharps, the anti-racist skinhead types?
Yeah. I was at a conference back in 1989 in Chicago, actually. It was the founding of a group called the Love and Rage Anarchist Federation.
This Chicago. This is my question. The Maxwell Street Greens, did they have anything political about them? They were a bunch of hippies who lived down in Maxwell Street. They had like a commune.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with them.
Okay. All right,
I'm not familiar with them. I was only in Chicago a brief time. That conference was going on while I was there. It was actually a former Trotskyite sect that put that together. There was a group called the Revolutionary Socialist League, which was a former Trotskyite group. They put out a paper called The Torch, and they had undergone a mass conversion within their group to anarchism. And they wanted to put together an anarchist group, and they started getting together with some anarchist groups from Minneapolis and Chicago, and they had this conference there and put that together. That group always had a very hard left, I guess, anti-racist, you could call it, line, in the sense that they talked a lot about white skin privilege and that kind of thing. And they actually had some sharp type skinheads involved with that group. But there was one guy who's actually still in left anarchist circles in Minneapolis. His name is Kieran Frazier. He was probably a teenager at that point, and he was one of these sharp skins, and he's still into that scene from what I hear.
Well, no, please keep talking. This is radio gold.
Okay. Yeah, but that was, so I was involved in that scene for a while. It was that kind of thing that actually motivated me to move away from the left, because I never shared that particular outlook. For example, the discussions you'd hear about, how evil white straight males are and so forth was always a big turnoff to me. I never really bought into that or, drank that particular
brand. I've heard Mr. Yeoman say things like that, that this is part of why he got disgusted with anarchism. Andrew? Can you?
Yeah, I started studying anarchism around when I was 16 or 17. I was, reading a lot.
You were in Detroit, right?
I was in Detroit, my hometown. And
actually,
I was
inside the city limit?
All around the Detroit area.
Livonia,
and
Dearborn Heights, Troy.
Yeah. And I was reading a lot of Nietzsche, I was reading a lot of philosophy, I was read Mein Kampf, and was reading the Communist Manifesto, and I was always had an interest in politics, and eventually read a book entitled Anarchism by a European guy, Rene Guenon. Forget his exact name, but
I think you're talking about Daniel Guren, Andrew.
Yeah, that's right. That's him. And his philosophy really appealed to me. Same with Bertrand Russell, and from what I knew of Noam Chomsky's work. And I was involved with various left-wing causes. And
at some point, you and I are going to have a knockdown, drag-out fight about the literary worth of Bertrand Russell.
Fair enough.
Okay.
So I was exploring various groups at the time, left and right, and I really settled into the anarchist scene when I discovered a anarchist housing collective in Detroit called the Trumbullplex Theater. And I was really impressed with how, in very austere circumstances, they were providing a living for themselves that was kind of outside of the system by growing their own food, attempts to making their own clothing, having their own free bus service, running on biofuel, and just some really creative innovations.
Listeners who aren't familiar with Detroit, let me say that if you want to pick a city where you can find farming space inside the city limits, Detroit is your place, because there's a lot of it is just not there anymore.
Yeah, that's true. And so I adopted anarchism as my own, and I was really influenced early on by different collectives such as Crime Think. I'm sorry?
Did you live in Trumbullplex?
I visited on occasions. And
you never actually, squatted with them?
Well, they weren't squatting. They owned the property. It was donated to their group.
How many were living in one house?
There was two houses, and at the time, I think there's probably about 20 people, 15 to 20.
Yeah.
Their rent was about $200 a month. And
It's like a co-op. The rent covers the food, too?
There were some group meals, but I don't think it was exclusively.
Okay. Well, that's I wonder how influenced that was by the ICC co-ops in Ann Arbor, because it sounds somewhat similar. Because Ann Arbor's right next door, and there's there's how many, 20 or 30 at least co-ops
yeah.
in a
it's like union. It's like in walking distance or so of our Wayne State University, which is also a very, very miniature version of University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. And
right.
So that's where I claimed my entry into the world of political activism. And
did you ever go to Ann Arbor? Was there anything happening in Ann Arbor, an anarchist house or what?
The only thing I did in Ann Arbor was go to Tibetan temples that they had available.
Oh,
and
really?
Bookstores. That was my only reason to go.
Ann Arbor does have a lot of bookstores.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Do they still have that annoying thing, the hash bash every spring where people not from the university go onto the campus and smoke pot?
Probably. I haven't been in Ann Arbor in at least probably 10 years.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's interesting. So So you were an anarchist. You sort of hung out with them as a teenager, and then you had was there a particular bad experience?
Well, there was one experience early on that really kind of threw me in a loop, and that was in, I think it was 2001, the Anarchist People of Color had a meeting. This is a collective of non-white anarchists, and they had a meeting that was applauded to much praise by the left anarchist scene. That they
fanfare.
Had fanfare for allowing no whites into their convention or meeting. And this was applauded across the spectrum. And I was really kind of taken aback by that because they're, you know, the normal left-wing line is that race, you know, is just a social construct. It doesn't matter. It's just a color of skin, et cetera. And here it was having real-world political effects in a radical scene that...
Asymmetrical effects.
Yeah, exactly. That claims to be against racism in all of its forms. And that's when I really started understanding that race was not... as a political issue is not something that could be ignored and or changed or something that you can change like your clothes. It's something that's who you are and you'll never be able to change that identity.
Right. And the left, the rule on the left is race is unimportant. Race is inadmissible if you're white and you're trying to get something out of it.
Right.
Right. You know, four legs good, two legs bad, if you ever read Animal Farm.
Right. And so for several years, I was able to ignore the issues of race or just kind of glossed over them until living in San Francisco, where race is in your face consistently, and especially all the stereotypes.
And it's complicated and, there because you've got Asian, too, which I don't really understand. We don't have that in Chicago.
I mean, all the Asian stereotypes are, I mean, I hate to say this, but true.
No tiki, and, no washi?
And it's, you know, it was just really disrespectful and disconcerting to be in an environment where that was so applauded.
But you were an anarchist when you moved out there.
I've been an anarchist since I was a teenager.
Out there and you were still a left-wing anarchist, I mean.
Yes.
Yeah. And this was after college? Did you go to college?
I am a high school dropout.
Good for you. So am I.
Excellent.
I have college degrees, but I actually was thrown out before finishing 10th grade.
Yeah.
But I believe they destroyed the high school building the next year. They felt that after I'd been there, it couldn't be used for any serious educational purpose. No, that's not actually.
Congratulations.
No, but so I just went to college. But the point is, I did get kicked out of high school.
Mm-hmm.
But so you moved out there. You're still a leftist. And then one day you go to your anarchist leftist spiritual advisor and you say, I've been having these doubts.
Well, I was exploring why these issues were the way that they were, and eventually I came across a Wikipedia article describing national anarchism. And
before that point, Andrew, did you ever have a moment where you were describing some of the things you were thinking about to a friend, and were told, Andrew, if you keep going down this path and thinking these things, you're going to end up being a Nazi or equivalent. Did anybody at that point say that?
No.
No. So you didn't understand where your thoughts were going to lead.
I knew exactly what I was doing.
Oh, I know. But okay.
And I knew what names that this would make me be called.
So you were aware, even as you started your ideological turn, you were aware of roughly where it was going, and you were aware that it was, in other words, you knew that you were going to be intensely disapproved of by your friends at that point.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and national anarchism is still intensely disapproved of in the local anarchist scene. However, there are some inroads being made in that direction. But
Listen, kids, if you're kids out there in Radio Land listening, if you're thinking about coming out as a racialist, as a national anarchist, you know, it's difficult. We can't advise you to do it or not to do it, but you know, there are adults who will help you in an appropriate way.
Well, I recommend everybody do it, if just for their peace of mind and for the courage of standing up for what they believe in.
Yes, join us.
The so-called social stigma that you might think you will have for having these views is very much overblown, especially by the enemy, and has been no negative side effects in my personal life. You know, there's been political associates who I don't associate with anymore, but that's not a real loss as far as I'm concerned.
Mr. Preston?
Well, my experience was fairly similar, Andrew's. I was involved in the left anarchist scene. I'm a little bit older than he is, so I was involved in that scene mostly in the late 80s and early 90s. I had already become discouraged with the left anarchist scene, probably by the early to mid-90s. I started looking at other philosophies, things like libertarianism and anarcho-capitalism and things like that, and started incorporating some of those ideas into my own approach. The moment of revelation for me was when I started becoming interested in the militia movement in the 1990s, the Patriot movement.
Oh, Mark from Michigan.
Yeah, I remember him, Mark Kernke, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Do you remember the kerfuffle about him and the Oklahoma City bombing?
Yeah, yeah.
He sent out a fax about the Oklahoma City bombing, and for a few hours it was believed that he sent out the fax before the bombing happened, which would have meant that he had foreknowledge of it. In fact, what it was is it was a time zone thing.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a time zone mistake.
Well, I think it's also been alleged Tim McVeigh was one of his bodyguards at one point or something. I've never seen any correlation.
The point is, that fax was sent out after the bombing, not before. But,
yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, the watchdog groups, the SPLC and all that, they've put out all kinds of crazy conspiracy theories about the militia movement. I mean, it's at least as crazy as any conspiracy theory.
Are either of you on the SPLC watch list or any other, famous watch lists?
Well, they had an article about national anarchism a while back that discussed Banna for the most part, Andrew's group, and I was referred to in it just on a very peripheral level.
Yeah, because when the SPLC lists you, then you know you've arrived.
When I started getting interested in the militia movement, that was I started noticing that a lot of the ideas they had actually overlapped quite a bit with the left anarchist movement in terms of, identifying common enemies and having some common issues, as far as
not including the black helicopters and the secret codes on the back of the
Highway. Yeah, not quite including some of that stuff, but a lot of the other stuff. And I remember having a conversation with a left anarchist and an anarcho-communist type sometime in the late 1990s, and I was saying that I thought, well, I just very casually dropped the line, yeah, I think the anarchist movement should start trying to work with some of these militia groups and see what we can do there. And he had this, he responded with this really horrified expression, oh my God, what are you saying? And it was on the level of telling a very fundamentalist Bible banger type of Christian that no, you no longer believe in Jesus Christ or something like that. It's that kind of a reaction. It's just not going to go over. I started looking into that issue more after that, because I had a few more experiences like that afterwards, and I started looking into what is it about these people that makes them react this way? What do they actually believe anyway? What is their real agenda? And I came to the conclusion that a lot of the left, including the anarchist left, wasn't so much about promoting the idea of anarchism, you know, as I had understood it anyway. I mean, although there's, you know, there's certainly some sincerity there on some of those kinds of issues. But more and more I came to see the left as essentially a racist movement in the sense that it's mostly just exists for the purpose of promoting racism against white people.
Right.
And out-group hostility against groups that are believed to be in some way privileged or hegemonic, you know, white males or straight white males or some people who are too Christian or, it's everything that they accuse the right of being, they are themselves, only in an inverse way.
Ah, yes. Andrew Breitbart, actually, I listened to him on a podcast the other day, but he was discussing, he's got a start with Matt Drudge, but now he's a sort of center right media guy. But anyway, there was a rally in the summer in in Utah for they have Sharon Angle versus Harry Reid, and mm-hmm. there was a rally for the Tea Party, and the Tea Party Express bus with Palin came in, and he drove in, and he found a group of left wing demonstrators with signs misleading Tea Partiers who were driving in from out of town looking for the venue and misdirecting them. So pretending that they were also Tea Partiers and sending people down the wrong road instead of the one to the real event. And while he was there, the Tea Party Express bus with Sarah Palin on it. I don't know. I maybe it was Sarah Palin. Anyway, the Tea Party Express bus goes by and these SEIU goons and Democratic Party goons start throwing eggs at it. Then they call the police, and the police show up and say to Andrew Breitbart, they tell me that you've been throwing eggs at buses. And he says, no, I have video. Those guys threw the eggs. So but he said, that's what the left is about, accusing other people of doing what they're doing. I'm sorry, that was kind of boring, wasn't it?
Well, no, I think you're right. I think that the left fundamentally misrepresents itself and its agenda. You know, I mean, for example, we're talking about the Southern Poverty Law Center. I mean, you know, what the hell do they have to do with poverty law? I mean, when have they ever been involved with any cases or any causes that have anything to do with poor people or advancing the interest of poor people?
Well, surely if they hurt whites, that must help poor people somehow, right?
Well, not when the majority of poor people are white.
Well, on a worldwide basis, sure. Anyway, you know, gentlemen, this has been 47 minutes. I like to keep these short, you know. Shorter than this normally. I have to say this was really a good time. If it wandered, if it wasn't focused, that's my fault. But you guys were really entertaining, and I expect to hear from our listenership that both of you will be wanted back very soon. And I'd like to ask, would both of you mind being on a sort of, just being available to, like, come in on conference calls and be recorded just sort of ad hoc without preparation?
I'm available depending on my schedule.
Right.
And so am I.
Right. Okay, well, I hope that you both got to say what you wanted to say.
I did. I enjoyed it. And Keith, I enjoyed having this back and forth with you, too.
Yeah, it's been a great program. Yeah. Thank you for having us on, Soren.
I've said it before. The secret to radio is enjoyment and relaxation of the hosts. If we can sound like we are actually friends and we know stories about each other and we're just having fun bantering like we would over a beer, that's what people want to hear. Now, obviously, we don't know each other. We're not friends. There's no beer. But you see my point.
Sure.
Indeed.
And the best way is to practice and to relax is to do it over and over again.
Yep.
Practice makes perfect.
All right. On the other hand, well, there are many sides. But let's talk again soon. RIP Alistair Clark, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good night.